Welcome into the back room of politics. I'm sure, like me, you've heard that term hate speech and wondered exactly what it might mean. The Royal Commission into the terrorist attacks at the Elnor Mosque and the Linwood Mosque in Christchurch saw 51 people murdered by a crazed gunman who had been using what is often termed hate speech in his internet feeds and various other publications prior to him transitioning from just the talk into the act. The Royal Commission made a number of recommendations to the government. Most of them have been acted on. Recommendation 40 called for a hate speech law. The government has today introduced a bill into Parliament that essentially makes it an offence under the Human Rights Act to incite on the grounds of religious belief. Now, the problem here is that it is a curtailment of some free speech. There might be issues at times that people have to speak out on, and you wouldn't want laws that actually make it hard for people to say what they're thinking, to have the free expression that we have in society. But at the same time, you don't want to have laws that are so loose that people can organise and ultimately perpetrate violent acts. So it's a tough one for lawmakers, for even the wider community to consider. So we need to better understand the threat, or the point at which threatening language, insightful language, violent language leads to violent acts. Today I'm joined by Dr. Chris Wilson of the University of Auckland, who has made quite a study of the way in which political violence is manifest, is developed, is sort of eventually worked into action. So Dr. Wilson, thank you very much for joining us in the back room of politics.
Hi Jerry, yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Tell me about your work. How would you describe it?
Yeah, I focus on political violence, quite broadly speaking, actually. I started off early in my career looking at ethnic conflict and insurgency, civil war. I moved on to genocide, and for about the past 5 years, I've looked at political extremism, radicalisation towards terrorist violence and other forms of political violence. And since the tragic events in Christchurch, I've had quite a strong focus on New Zealand.
I think some of your work, which I've read, it's quite sobering, because to think that we all go about our lives not really knowing that this stuff might be going on around us, and for you to be so deeply involved in it is quite interesting. I'm also interested in how you conducted some of your most recent research in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very sobering topic, and we can talk more about that when we talk about hate speech, because the world and the country looks different depending on who you are. So for people like you and I, it looks one way, and for a lot of minorities and people of colour, it looks another way, both the online environment and offline. So they are facing a lot of these threats are actually a lot more sort of palpable and in their face, if you will, compared to, you know, what somebody like I see, you know, aside from my research. My recent focus of research has probably two main pillars. We've got a research group at the University of Auckland called, it's an acronym HIRE, but Hate and Extremism Insights Aotearoa. The two main pillars are probably qualitative research into far-right groups. It's very much a focus on the far-right in the New Zealand context. A focus on far-right groups, in particular Action Zealandia. So we've had a colleague of mine infiltrated the group for about 18 months, was a member of the group for about 18 months. So we researched that group and have written about them. One of the key, the initial focus of the research was to find out how much risk they posed to New Zealand society, minorities in particular, but to people on the left and all sorts of normal targets of people on the far right. Over time, over that period that he was a member of the group, we noticed that these guys talk up a storm online, but they didn't actually put their words into action. There's a number of reasons for that, which we can go into as we talk more in depth about that. But so one of the questions for me became, why has this group, which is explicitly far right, explicitly extremist, hasn't engaged in terrorist violence? The other pillar of my research is more focused on the online. The bigger picture is trying to put together the online and the offline worlds and to create a comprehensive picture of the risk of extremist violence in New Zealand.
Can I just break in there for a moment? Yeah. So when you we'll pick that up, but what we're talking about when you mentioned that the name of that group, these are people who regularly express views that would be considered hate speech, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So they're white supremacists. They're misogynist,
yep.
And they generally are pretty hateful individuals. But please, your second tranche, you look at the interface.
Yeah. So looking at the interface between the online and the offline worlds, which was very much looking at Action Zealandia as well. We were looking at the disjuncture between how they acted online and how they acted offline. So the other main pillar of our research is we've developed a pretty sophisticated tool for examining online discourse, New Zealand-based posters who are posting on, you know, the most dangerous extreme places on the internet, Gab, 4chan, those sort of places, the sort of places that, for example, the Christchurch terrorist announced his plans to attack Elanor Mosque in Lynwood. And what we do is we take in all of that data. One of the key questions that I spoke about, I presented at the government's CVE HUI up here a few weeks ago. One of the key points that I tried to make was there is so much of this online rhetoric now that it's almost impossible for researchers and for government and security agencies to be able to work out, to filter out the noise effectively and be able to work out what's concerning. So what we're doing, because there's no social license for mass surveillance in New Zealand, and so ultimately security agencies have to rely to a certain extent on public tip-offs. And there have been a number of high-profile cases where they have actually relied upon on those sort of tip-offs. What we're trying to do, or what we are doing, is trying to find the most concerning subset of that online rhetoric to identify what are the most concerning and dangerous trends, topics, risks, who are the groups that are most likely to be targeted, and the way that that's changing within New Zealand society over time. So those are the two main pillars of my research at the moment.
Yeah, pretty valuable research. I mean, I have a little bit of engagement with the oversight of the security agencies that we have in New Zealand. And they do have quite a task, given that we also have a strong view in New Zealand that none of us should be under any surveillance as a matter of course. Mm. And long may that be the case. I'm certainly not in favour of that. Mm. The question becomes, I think, around a law that prohibits hate speech. Firstly, the question is, what is hate speech and how do you define it? And secondly, if there was to be a suppression of that type of rhetoric, what is that likely to mean for the person that's building up and obviously got a lot of hate in them, but wants to express it in some particular way? And I'm intrigued by you were just hinting at there before that a lot of them will go online, they'll engage in this sort of talk, but then there's absolutely no action at all beyond that. Mm. Would you reflect on how much the sort of media coverage of that terrorist attack, of other terrorist activities, of the fact that people are being, that there is a method out there to get hold of these people, does deter their activity?
Yeah, okay, there's quite a lot there.
Yeah,
that's all right. I'll try and remember most of those questions. In terms of the definition of hate speech, you know, to go right back to that start, which I think is really important. There are difficulties, like most of these sort of issues, there are difficulties defining it. Probably the most important definition is speech that vilifies, abuses, ridicules, dehumanises or perhaps even incites hostility and potentially violence against a particular group, any of those things. It doesn't need to be violence. So that's probably the most important thing that we're focusing on. The other question that you raise, I argued in my research into Action Zealandia and made a broader point that a lot of these people do engage in a lot of online rhetoric that is very, very hateful, but they don't put those words into action. And to a certain extent, that the community building that goes on and the expression of hateful rhetoric does actually act as almost like a pressure release valve, however you want to, whatever term you want to use,
yeah.
Which it's actually an unpopular, it was an unpopular thing. I copped a, you know, a fair bit of criticism for making that point. I think the key thing to keep in mind is that the rhetoric itself, so the vast majority of people don't engage in violence, but some do. And so the key thing to remember is that of the people who have, the very, very small number of people who engage in this type of rhetoric online, the people who have gone on and committed an attack, like in Christchurch and El Paso and Buffalo and numerous other places, those are people who have been engaging in this sort of interaction explicitly online. They're not people out who are out in a group and so on. So these are people who have been living online and have been engaging in this sort of stuff. So there is something happening here. You know, this online rhetoric does drive particular individuals in particular circumstances to violence. So it is something important. It's not. So we shouldn't get too caught up in the idea that there's so many people out there and this rhetoric is so widespread that it doesn't have an impact, because it does. There are a number of features of it, if I've got time to just mention those.
Go for it.
A number of features of the online environment, and particularly the way that the internet is now and a lot of websites are now, that drive, that push people more towards more militant positions on any topic that they're discussing. There's a whole range of dynamics, so there's the echo chamber dynamic that, you know, we've known about for a long time, that people seek out like-minded people and communities, and then they get stuck in that, you know, that's where they feel most comfortable, and so they never hear any other opposing views. And that is within those environments, you don't hear, you know, a reason from the other side, and so that these people just push each other along. And they do push each other along because the whole dynamic of these types of websites is to get people to become more radical. The more extreme the thing you say, the more abusive, the more misogynistic, the more shocking, the more likes they get, the more status and kudos they get within that community. So there are particular dynamics that do push people along towards more militant and radical positions.
How many numbers are we talking, say, as far as you could assess, in New Zealand who are engaging in this? I mean, obviously they engage internationally because that's just the way that the internet, but
yep.
How many would be sitting at in front of their screens in New Zealand?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer, how many people. I've got this, one of the studies that we've done just recently was we looked at over time, from 2018 to 2000 to today, to look at New Zealand-based posters who are engaging in what is defined as hate speech based on a database of a freely accessible database of hate speech terms.
And what's that telling you? You've got a graph that you show me here.
So the graph that I've got here shows a massive spike since early 2021. The numbers get really, really high, but around February this year, around the time of the protests in Wellington and so on. The rhetoric that's involved is not necessarily COVID or COVID-related or conspiracy theory-related. So those types of dynamics are actually pushing far-right and misogynistic and other, that type of interaction higher as well. So the numbers get very, very high. I'll give you this graph. The numbers get very, very high, but as you can see, it's just increasing.
So just so we're clear, if you go to the bottom of your graph, it's what year?
That's March 2018.
2018, yep. And by the time you get to March...
So it's September 2022.
And the spike is...
So the numbers are very high.
Yeah.
So this is so we're looking at 8,000, this is weekly posts,
right,
that were captured by this hate speech at its peak. So they're pretty high numbers. So I can't say how many individuals.
Yeah. So the question I'd have is, yeah, how many of those... individuals were fired up over one sort of little aspect of New Zealand society at the time. So in fact, the COVID lockdown, the vaccine mandate and that sort of thing.
Clearly the spike around that time, around the mandates and around the protests, was triggering a lot of people to engage in this type of rhetoric. But the issues are pretty standard over time, actually. It's the similar sort of far-right topics, anti-Semitism, misogyny, and so on. Those topics remain fairly standard over time, consistent over time, which I've got in another graph in a report that Hire did. So people are getting triggered by this, by particular topics. One of the key things that we find in research is that hate speech is often spikes after particular events, particular shocking events like a terrorist attack, for example, or COVID, the measures to mitigate it, its effects. They spike temporarily, and then that hate speech spikes, then it drops down. But it never drops down to the level before the event. So the plateaus at a higher level. So the baseline just continues to increase over time.
Right. So even if you're looking at that high spike number, approaching 8,000 posts, I suppose you'd say individual posts, or some of them would have been dual posts or multiple posts by one individual, or is that estimated to be the number of people that were on the keyboard at that time?
These are posts, so right. Rather than users, yeah.
You're right. So when you look at it, that number of posts compared to everything that goes on Facebook, everything that goes on Instagram, and every other sort of social media channel at the moment, that's a relatively small number on a daily basis. So my question is, and it's a question I think all politicians will be asking, is, how much do we have a new hate speech law designed to slow these people down that might have started to impact on our general ability to speak freely in this country?
This is a tricky question, and it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't, as far as I'm concerned, type problem.
It is very much, yeah.
So, as I was saying before, a small number of these, they are small numbers. This doesn't include Facebook and Twitter, for example, and the numbers will be far higher.
They're kind of so-called hidden channels, the dark side.
The fringe websites, fringe platforms. The question of free speech versus, and I'm not a legal scholar, right? Like, I focus on how this stuff pushes people towards violence and how, and the levels at which it's doing it and how it's increasing and so on, and the topics. The question of free speech versus hate speech is, I think, one of the things in the recent, so we had a year ago, we had the debate when Minister Farfoy brought the legislation, and then we've sort of had it again under Kerry Allen just recently, and the government has decided to focus on religious groups as opposed to, and drop some of the other groups, as, we can talk. I can give my opinions on all those, but as I say, I'm not a legal scholar.
Sure.
One thing that struck me in both of those debates was that there's very much a focus on the problems of doing something, on the problems of and how it was going to undermine, impinge on free speech. But there's not too much discussion on what happens if we don't do anything. What happens if we say, yes, it's going to impinge on free speech, so we leave it? Because something is, the levels are increasing, it is driving violence, not just violence, it's driving online harms. And I'm I come at this as somebody, I have very objective, kind of try and have very measured views about these things. I'm not an activist, I'm an academic, so I'm trying to come at it with a bit of rigour.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
But the impacts of online are pretty extensive. Victims report, mental health issues, fear, a lack of willingness to participate in society, relationship breakdowns, those sorts of things. And that's just from the online harm. The other...
harm from the internet chatter the harm to the individual that's on the end of the keyboard? Some kind of definition, not definition, description, I suppose, of who might be more likely to engage in this sort of activity?
That's a whole kind of field of study, is trying to, it's difficult to profile, but just to answer your first question, that I was talking about the victims of it, the people who are exposed to it, because and I'll come back to that second question about the perpetrators, because there's a lot of harms that are done to these people who are exposed to it. And studies show across a whole range of countries, we don't have, in all of these things that I'll mention, our data in New Zealand are a little bit lacking. They're rudimentary, they're basic, they've only just started being collected on hate speech, the impacts on hate crimes, physical hate crimes, offline, actual assaults and so on. These are things that police and other agencies are working on now, but it needs to be refined, and we really need to do a lot more work on that. In fact, to my mind, I think probably as much focus should be put on that hate crime issue through legislation as well as hate speech, but I'm digressing a little bit here. There are a whole lot of consequences that are given to people, that are imposed on people. And something to keep in mind again is, and I guess I'm coming back to that point about being, a white middle-aged male, is to keep in mind young people, like we don't come across it much. Young people come across it all the time.
Yeah.
They're talking about, so some of the studies say on average about 50% of people will have come across some form of hate speech, not directed at them, but seen it online. For young people, those numbers go up to, say 70%, the higher. And they're higher again for people of colour and LGBT community, which is actually very high, the numbers. The numbers of people who have actually been targeted them directly themselves, again, it's those LGBT community is about 26% or something. So, I mean, those numbers are pretty high. That's what I mean when I say that, these groups are experiencing it differently to the rest of, to some of us, the majority groups.
It is a serious concern, because there has to be some reason for the high incidence of people suffering from mental health conditions in New Zealand. I wonder if there is a percentage of that that's directly related to hearing bad things about yourself from people that are too ignorant to understand that they've not objectively perfect in their own right.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, your point about the perpetrators before is also important, because there's not just an impact on the victims, but there is an impact on people who are engaging in this. I mentioned before that it's almost like a spiral of radicalization, that they are pushing each other to become more and more radical and militant and engage in this kind of banter online, bravado, and it does actually lead to some people deciding that they want to put their words into action. I said in another interview recently that, there are a number of people who have gone, several terrorists of some of the worst terrorist attacks recently who have said, I'm sick of talking about it online, I need to put my words into action. So there is that. But even lower forms of political violence, such as hate crimes, there are pretty strong studies that show increasing levels of hate speech online leads to increasing levels of offline hate crimes, assaults, harassment, abuse, and so on. So there's quite strong, the spikes go and they follow each other. So for people online who are engaging in this type of rhetoric, they do get the sense that they're part of a community. They do get made to feel like they're more confident in going out and doing things that they never would have done in the past. Because when in the past, and actually still to a large extent now, you don't do things online. You feel much more comfortable doing things online than you do offline. You can abuse somebody because you're not going to be...
No consequence.
Yeah, you've got no consequence.
Yeah. So, no pushback.
But somehow that spills over, and that language spills over. I mean, you saw it with all the death threats and so on in Wellington, and the way that people started to speak about politicians and you can see that kind of rhetoric is spilling over into the offline world.
Yeah, right.
So it does have a consequence on the people who are engaging it, and feeds into offline action, which in turn again feeds back into the online stuff, and it becomes like this loop. And the consequences are, I talked about the consequences for victims, but there are also consequences for New Zealand society in terms of our political system, the willingness of groups to participate, the social cohesion, which is a bit of a buzz term these days, but these things do have an impact on that.
So just trying to get a bit of a understanding of it, maybe even, I don't know if you can speculate on a profile for the person that might be engaged in this sort of activity, and what those triggers are. We tend to think in New Zealand, the vast majority of people, that we've got a pretty good life here, but there's clearly a lot of people who are quite isolated inside their own lives and from the benefits of the wider society. That must lead to a broad description of the persons most likely to join these groups. And then perhaps even engage in some of their group activities. So what are we looking at there?
Yeah. Trying to profile any type of criminal or any group is kind of a little bit fraught. But there are some patterns that you can kind of identify. Most of the attackers or the people who join groups or engage in hate crimes are generally white males of a particular age group. They seem to be getting younger. So initially, you know, it has been 18 to 30, but they seem to be getting younger. Overseas, there's a real problem with school-age children as young as 12, 13, through to 15, 18, who are becoming, embracing these ideas, incel, involuntary celibate ideas, far-right ideas, and engaging in, you know, in this sort of stuff, and being radicalised and actually being referred to PREVENT, which is the countering terrorism strategy in the UK, or even being arrested.
That's a very worrying trend.
It's a really worrying trend.
Particularly when you have in New Zealand the dreadful truancy problem that we've got at the moment.
Yep.
And you know, so many young people just simply not turning up to the ordinary institution of school.
Yeah.
What did you refer them as, the incel? What is that particular philosophy?
Yeah, incel is short for involuntary celibate, which is a group of an online community of young men who believe that they are not able to find a sexual romantic partner because they don't meet society's expectations threshold of being handsome enough and sporty enough and so on. And so these guys, there are websites, you know, image boards, chat rooms that are specifically set up for these young men mostly, and they talk about how their, you know, they, you know, their facial features are not right and not what women want. They say that women are very, this is what, you know, the sort of things they say. They say women are very shallow and they only want a sporty guy who's got lots of money or whatever. There's a whole lot of these sort of things that go on, and it generates quite strong misogyny, and which has, just like these other forms of hate speech leading to violence that I've been talking about, does lead to offline violence. There's been a whole range of quite deadly attacks.
Are these guys generally in work?
Incels, if, you know, if we're to stereotype and we're to just talk about general patterns, most of the people like incels, people who are involved in far-right ideology, are generally underemployed, I guess would probably be the best way of putting it. You know, they might be working, but they might be in low-status occupations. Or they might, a lot of incels are young as well, so school-aged children. The figure that I was talking about a lot of young people in the UK are being referred to PREVENT, that's, you know, the system. Most of they, now that they have this new category called mixed, unstable and unclear. So they've got far right jihadist, and now they have this new one of MUU, mixed, unstable and unclear, which is a whole people who you can't really work out why, what it is that's driving them to this kind of angry ideology. They just want to engage in violence and abuse people and so on. The majority of those are incel related.
Right.
And a lot of them are coming from schools that are referring them. So the incel ideology has really increased in school children.
Do they identify that way themselves, or is it a term that's applied to a group of people?
Yeah, they recognise.
Right.
It's kind of a community, you know, everybody wants to be part of a community, I guess.
Right.
So yeah, they refer to themselves as that, or, you know,
It's interesting you use that term, low status employment. That's something that's bothered me for a very long time, that there can be various levels of status applied to someone's employment, when, you know, my life would be a complete mess if someone didn't do the most menial things in society. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way at all, but does that all sort of tend to say, well, we should be doing a lot more to help people recognise that there is a basis for self-esteem, that you don't have to be a victim of your own views of what other people think?
I think that's a really good suggestion. I think that's as good an intervention as any, is to let people know that, you know, they are valued and they are part of society, and what they're doing is important, and to give people opportunity. You mentioned before about, you know, the profiles, and a lot of these people are, you know, the stereotype is that they are stuck at home upstairs at their parents' house or whatever, you know, online. That's, you know, there is something to that stereotype. So there's a lot of, and all people who are alone and living by themselves, this, you know, increasing isolation within society, even before COVID, and, you know, especially since then. People are spending every year, spending more and more time online. So there's a lot of isolation, there's a lot of sense of feeling like they've been left behind by society, you know, and they're in low status employment, if they're in employment at all. There's an academic term that we call relative deprivation as well, which we, that people, it's not just about their absolute position in society, but it's about how, where they believe they should be. And that's where a lot of the kind of the racial or ethnic division comes in as well. You often get a lot of young white men who go that, you know, I feel isolated and left behind by society and I'm low status. And then they look at people of colour and immigrants and so on, and they blame them for seemingly having taken a higher position in society. That's a real key, that relative deprivation of not being where you believe you are. You know, a lot of scholars would explain the rise of Trump and so on as, you know, having been driven by that within the white community in the US.
Yeah, so the counter to all of that is sounds quite generational, that you can't just do that overnight. But I do think that we do have to have a lot more focus on just the value of being a human, contributing and able to contribute to society at whatever level that might be, without any sort of expectation. And I think for too long, it's a personal views now, of course, but we have had a view that, you know, success was going to university, getting a degree, getting a flash job, etc. Really, it's like anything else, it's just a ticket. And, you know, as I said before, the most... And I don't, again, so I don't mean this to be derogatory, most a menial job in life would makes my life a hell of a lot better if people are doing it well. So that's very interesting. Mm. I think your work is incredibly important, particularly where you're suggesting that you hope the work might lead to a better ability to pick out what is problematic hate speech that might lead to crime, and or to the taking the ultimate sort of action of threatening others' lives and perhaps taking them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And any sort of idea of when that might materialise as a sort of a piece of work that our enforcement agencies, our security services, others could look to for that kind of, prevention, I suppose you'd say.
Well, we're already working quite closely with DIA. So this report that I sent you, I presented at the HUI a month ago, that was done and supported by DIA, working with, you know, we work with a number of agencies. So HIRE is very much, we are trying to establish an entity to be able to do, you know, to actually be able to. New Zealand's a little bit of a world leader in this kind of area. Well, there's got a lot of soft power. You know, a lot of it comes down to the Prime Minister, but also the leading the Christchurch call and so on. HIRE is, you know, I guess, hopefully, you know, I sort of like to see us as part of that, being able to do take a little bit of a world leading approach to identifying these trends. We need it in New Zealand, but it's also, you know, it's potentially exportable if you like. What we're doing is we use a number of techniques to be able to identify the emotion behind the post that was written. So when people write a post, you know, there's this whole sea of hate speech online and negative rhetoric. What we do is use natural language techniques to be able to identify how much emotion was behind the post when the poster wrote it. So we're able to identify those people who are actually feeling angry and frustrated and lonely, and are committed to a cause, and so therefore may put their words into action. So these are things. So I've spoken to a number of government agencies, shall we say, about this work, and so, you know, we're sort of going ahead in leaps and bounds and engaging in a number of studies. There was this study that I presented at the HUI. Another one that I've done, which I'm about to finish, is, or a couple that I'm just about to finish, One shows that the first is on hate speech in New Zealand. So this one here is this graph that I showed you before is based on an international database that's able to pick up all of these terms that are being used by New Zealand-based posters. The second one, to add to that, we're very much focused on particular groups: Māori, women, LGBTQI, and Jews, Muslims within New Zealand, and a number of other groups. And then work out the levels of speech, hate speech targeted at those groups, and whether they're changing over time. We've got a number of a fair bit of work in the New Zealand context.
So your work is, to say the least, encouraging and very, very valuable. And thank you for it. But I think we should leave on a fairly positive note. And you can't look quite bleakly at what the possibilities are. But as long as there is that work being done to identify these people, we still live in a pretty good country that's got the ability to speak freely, the ability to move freely, but recognising that sometimes some people will abuse those freedoms to the detriment of others. And that's the challenge, I think, for legislators and how we might sort that out moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that we try and do is not to engage in hyperbole or not to exaggerate the threat. We're not, and apologies to your American listeners, but we're not America. We haven't quite polarised quite as much, and we don't have the levels of rhetoric that America does, and we don't have the levels of political violence. I don't think we ever will get to that stage, and so but the key is just to keep an eye on that, make sure that we are not heading off in directions that are concerning.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of problems in New Zealand, but there's a lot that we should be thankful for and make sure that we don't stuff it up
moving forward.
Yeah.
Dr. Chris Wilson, thank you very much for being in the background of politics today. This has been a very interesting discussion, and if anyone wants to look up your work, I'd recommend that they do. It's kind of comforting to know that we've got people taking a really strong interest in how we combat this adverse aspect of our society. So thanks very much.
Cheers, thanks, Jerry.